Well, I'm confusing my two sections again. Is 17 where we ended? Okay. I've already talked about this slide, but before we go on, let's review where we're at. What is the overall process we're studying? The whole process in the unit. Right, the complete oxidation of glucose. And that has two major parts, right? What's the first part?
Glycolysis?
Right, glycolysis is the first part of the complete oxidation of glucose. And the reason that the whole process is called the complete oxidation is because that's the only way you can get all of the usable energy out of glucose is to completely oxidize it. Glycolysis starts the process, but it's only partial oxidation, which is why the output of glycolysis is still useful fuel. What is that output? Well, it makes some ATP, which is part of the goal, but what else?
NADH.
Also makes NADH, which is holding some of the energy temporarily that was in the glucose, but fuel-wise, what is left over after glycolysis?
It's the pyruvate.
Right. And pyruvate still has a multi-carbon skeleton, and it still has hydrogen atoms attached to it, so it hasn't gotten all of its energy picked from it. That's why glycolysis is only partial oxidation of glucose. Cellular respiration, which is the second part of the overall process, evolved as a way to finish the job fuel-wise. In other words, cellular respiration starts where glycolysis leaves off. And it takes that partially spent fuel, which is the pyruvate, and oxidizes it the rest of the way. Completely dismantles the carbon skeleton, completely picks off the hydrogens. So that by the time you're done with the fuel, all that's left over is CO2. All right. Now we're already past that point because we've gotten farther than the elimination of the fuel. But let's review what the three major parts of cellular respiration are. Cellular respiration itself is part two of the overall process, complete oxidation of glucose. But cellular respiration is broken into three parts just itself. What is the first part? That's the second part. What happens in cellular respiration before the citric acid cycle? Well, what are you starting with? What does cellular respiration start with?
Pyruvate.
And so the first part involves pyruvate. What is the name of the first part? Exactly, the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. That part doesn't produce any additional ATP, but it does produce some NADH, which is what that's why part of the name is oxidative. The pyruvate gets oxidized, and that allows for the NAD plus to get reduced into the high energy form NADH. All right, then you have the citric acid cycle, and it's the citric acid cycle, part two of cellular respiration, that completes the spending of the fuel, the oxidation of the fuel. So by the time the citric acid cycle is done, there is no fuel remaining. That one 6-carbon glucose molecule has been completely picked of hydrogens and dismantled, carbon skeleton-wise, into 6 CO2 molecules. Each of which is worthless as far as energy extraction is concerned. So the fuel is gone. But although some of the energy was wasted as heat along the way, a lot of the energy has been stored at this point, because there was some ATP that was produced in glycolysis, that's storing energy, of course. There was some NADH and H+ that was made in glycolysis, that's storing even more energy. There's more NADH and H+ that was produced in the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, that's more energy that was in glucose. Then in the citric acid cycle, more ATP is produced, storing energy. More NADH and H+ is produced, a lot more. And FADH2, a different kind of coenzyme, is reduced in the citric acid cycle, and that's carrying energy as well. So by the time you're done with part two of cellular respiration, when you eliminate the heat that was wasted, because you can't do anything about that, all of the usable energy, since there is no more fuel left, all of the usable energy that was in glucose is in the form already either of ATP, which is the goal, or NADH and H+, reduced coenzyme, in other words, and FADH2, reduced coenzyme. Now, these reduced coenzymes, these taxis, are not the goal. Their job as taxis is to carry the energy that they're carrying in the form of electrons and protons that used to be in glucose to a destination, so that there can be a final payoff in the form of production of even more ATP. That's why, even though the fuel is gone in part two, you need part three of cellular respiration to deal with all this stored energy that these taxis are carrying, so that you can finally get that into the form of ATP with some waste, of course, in heat. That's what part three is all about. Now, what is the name of part three of cellular respiration?
Carboxylic acid cycle?
No, that's another name for the citric acid cycle. It can go by Krebs cycle, citric acid cycle, tricarboxylic acid cycle. Those are interchangeable terms. So that's part two. Correct. Oxidative phosphorylation is part three of cellular respiration. And notice that it says phosphorylation. So something's getting phosphorylated. Well, what is it that's going to get phosphorylated? Would you guess? We haven't gotten there yet. What does phosphorylated mean? What does it mean for something to be phosphorylated? What is it? Not a phosphorus, not a single atom. A phosphate group. So remember, the goal is to produce ATP. You produce ATP by phosphorylating ADP. That's like making a deposit into the debit account. We've already done that a couple places along the way already, right? We've made some ATP, and that was by substrate level phosphorylation. So-called because a substrate that was carrying a phosphate bound to an enzyme and passed that phosphate from the substrate to ADP to make ATP. But that is not nearly as much ATP as you can make if you use all the usable energy that was originally in glucose, and that is now, at the moment, as we get to part three, in the form of reduced coenzymes, NADH and FADH2. Right? So part three is overall called oxidative phosphorylation, but part three itself has two subparts. What are the two components of part three? The two components of oxidative phosphorylation.
Electron transport.
Right. Electron transport was part 3A, we'll say.
That's what's on the board.
And that's what's on the board. That's what we've already talked about a little bit. And what's the second part of part three?
Chemiosmosis.
Chemiosmosis, exactly. Chemiasmosis, as we'll see, is where we're going to have finally the big payoff in terms of ATP. But let's review what we learned about electron transport, which is slide 17. Electron transport is really just a series of redox reactions, right? Because whenever an electron gets transported from one substance to another, that by definition is redox. Something is getting reduced, the thing that's receiving the electron, and something's getting oxidized, the thing that's losing the electron. Well, the first member of the electron transport chain gets reduced by receiving an electron, but then it quickly becomes reoxidized because it's going to pass it to the second member, reducing the second member. And so on down the line. It's just a series of redox reactions. Why bother to do this? Because every time there is a transfer of electrons from one member to the next in the chain, the electron loses a little bit of energy. It goes down. That's why this is a graph. The Y value is G here. So each downhill step means some energy is released. It goes to lower energy, the electrons, because they end up, each time they're passed to another member, getting a little bit closer to an atomic nucleus than they were before. And closer to the nucleus means lower energy level. Does that all make sense? This is how we stepwise, instead of all at once, release the energy, so that we can manage it. All right, so there's a release of energy. Where does the electrons come from when they're delivered to the chain? The first member has to receive the electrons before it can pass it to the second member and so on. But where does the first member get it from? Right, the first member gets it from the taxis that have been driving these electrons around. They've picked up the electrons from the hydrogen that got picked off of the fuel. Each hydrogen atom that was originally in glucose is an electron and a proton. The electrons get picked up by these taxis. That reduces the taxis, right, into their high-energy reduced form, NADH and H+. Plus, in the citric acid cycle, we have a different kind of taxi doing the same thing. FAD gets reduced into FADH2. They're all driving to the same destination to drop those electrons off, and that's electron transport chains. Okay, so that allows for the energy that they're carrying to be released. But if all you do is release the energy, that would just be a total waste of that energy, right? The point is you have to harness the energy in order to exploit it, in order to have that energy do some work for you. And that's why the electron transport chains don't accomplish just electron transport. All that would do would heat the cell up with that release of energy. They also do a very important second function. Well, at least the three big members here, the three biggest protein complexes, numbers 1, 3, and 4, accomplish this second job. And that second job is to pump protons. You don't see the membrane that this whole chain is embedded in, but the membrane is there. That's where you find each copy of an electron transport chain. It's embedded in the inner mitochondrial membrane, which is the membrane that separates two different spaces within the mitochondrion, right? It separates the intermembrane space, which is the space between the two membranes, and the compartment that's fully inside the inner membrane. What is that compartment called? The full interior of the, I shouldn't say full interior, the interior of the inner membrane of the mitochondrion is called what? It's a its own compartment. It's called the matrix, or mitochondrial matrix. Okay? And the membrane, the inner membrane, is between those two compartments, the matrix and the intermembrane space. So you can think on this graph, even though the anatomy isn't shown here, the space below the chain would be the matrix. The space above the chain would be the intermembrane space. Complexes 1, 3, and 4 are acting as pumps for protons. And what does that tell you? If I tell you that they're pumps, what does that tell you? What do you know about pumps?
They can move things against the gravity?
Exactly. In other words, pumps work by active transport, not passive. We call active transport proteins pumps. And they can move things against their gradient, as you correctly stated, which means they can take, in this case, protons, what's being pumped here, they take protons from where they're already low concentration and force them through the membrane to the other compartment where they're already at higher concentration. That creates the gradient and it maintains the gradient as the pumps continue to work. Well, what else do you know about pumps? How does pumping work? Right. Pumps, since they are active transporters, have to be supplied with energy or they cannot work. They're working against a gradient. They're not using the energy of a gradient like diffusion does. They have to have an outside source of energy to force it to happen. Well, we looked at a proton pump in the plant example when we looked at primary and secondary active transport with the sucrose. Remember that slide? What was the source of energy for the proton pump in the plant, Sal? And we also looked at pumps that you have by the quadrillions in your body. Those are the sodium-potassium exchange pumps. What's the source of energy for them? Which is the same as for it is for proton pumps in the plant.
Was it ATP?
It was ATP. ATP is frequently, but not always, the source of energy for doing things in cells, including running pumps. But think about the goal here of this overall process, which is to make ATP. It would be silly if you spent ATP on these pumps when the goal is to make ATP, right? Still, though, a pump cannot operate unless it has a source of energy. So what is the source of energy for these three complexes that are pumping protons? Any idea?
You said that since over each step the electron loses energy, right?
Yes.
Would that be it?
That's exactly it. That's the whole reason electrons are transported, so that their release of energy can be put to use powering these three complexes as pumps. So instead of using ATP to power the pumps, the electrons that were originally in glucose being transported down these chains releases the energy that powers the pumps. And as long as that electron transport is happening, then protons are taken from the matrix, pumped through the inner membrane into the intermembrane space. That's where they're being stockpiled. There's a higher concentration now in the intermembrane space of protons than there are in the matrix. This accounts for both halves, both parts of each hydrogen that was taken from the fuel, right? When you take a hydrogen from the glucose originally, you're really taking an electron and a proton. The electrons get transferred down the chain eventually once they get delivered by the taxis. And the protons get pumped. So the two parts of each hydrogen is doing a different thing here. But they're going to be reunited. Well, not necessarily the same electron and same proton, but since they're all interchangeable. An electron and a proton will come back together at the end. And this has to do with why you breathe. Last time, I think we talked about the fact that you can't have continuous electron transport down this chain unless you have something continuously at the end willing to receive the electrons off of the end. Just like the person at the end of the bucket brigade having to get rid of the water onto the fire in order to be able to receive a new bucket. If you don't have something at the end taking electrons off the end of the chain, then the chain will simply fill up with electrons and no more transport will happen, and therefore the pumps will shut down. Well, this is why you breathe oxygen. Oxygen serves as the final electron acceptor for the electron transport chains in your mitochondria. And it's very well suited for the job because oxygen has a high electronegativity. It is more than willing to take those electrons, just like oxygen hogs the electrons in an OH bond in water, right, that we've talked about. So it will gladly take the electrons at the end of the chain. Each electron is half of a hydrogen that used to be on the fuel. But it also takes a proton, which is the other half of the hydrogen that used to be in the fuel. In other words, oxygen not only receives electrons, it receives electrons and protons and therefore receives hydrogens. And the hydrogens combining with the oxygen is what makes water. The oxygen that you breathe gets combined with hydrogens that started out as food that you ate, and that produces molecules of water, which explains why in the summary reaction for the overall process, remember we looked at the summary reaction? You start with glucose and oxygen. Those are the two things you need. You end up with CO2, completely spent fuel, what's left of the glucose, and water, because the oxygen that you breathe takes those hydrogens from the fuel and makes water. Does that make sense? All right, now, this is not the end. We're in part three, which is the last part of cellular respiration, but we're only in the first part of part three. This is electron transport. So consider where we are at this moment. Freeze the clock. And we no longer have any fuel now. We also no longer have any valuable full taxis, because the taxis have all delivered their energy in the form of electrons to the chains. But we still haven't made any more ATP, right? So if you don't have energy in the taxis anymore and you don't have any fuel left, where is the energy, the useful energy, the one that hasn't been wasted as heat, where is it? The energy that was originally in glucose and that we haven't already put into the form of ATP, where is that energy right now? Well, to answer that, you have to think back to something I keep telling you throughout the term about gradients. What do you know about gradients? They are forms of stored energy that can do some work for you. So that's the answer. The energy that has not already been put into ATP form and has not already been wasted as heat, at this point is in the form of the proton gradient that was created using the energy from the electrons being transported. The cell doesn't really want those electrons to be on one side. It's creating that gradient for the purpose of using that gradient to do some work. Just like if you put in the work of lifting water uphill to spill it on a water wheel, it will turn the water wheel. because that gravitational gradient pays off in the form of doing some work. All right, that's what electron transport, the first part of oxidative phosphorylation, accomplishes. The establishment and maintenance of a proton gradient across the inner membrane of the mitochondrion. And when I first talked about gradients, when I described this in the lab, I said that a gradient is the tendency for diffusion to occur, right? If there is a gradient in place, which there is now for protons, that means the protons want to diffuse back down the gradient. They want to diffuse back to where they got pumped from, meaning they want to go back through the membrane into the matrix, down their own gradient. Just like in the plant cell example, those protons wanted to come back into the cell. And when they did, they had to go through that co-transporter, remember? And that forced sucrose along for the ride. So that was the work that was accomplished. But the protons were diffusing passively down their gradient, since the gradient existed, and the sucrose was dragged along. That's an example of a gradient doing some work for you. That was secondary active transport back in that chapter. We're going to look at basically the same thing, but with a different result. That's the second part of part 3 of cellular respiration. The second part of oxidative phosphorylation is chemiosmosis. Let's look at slide 18 to make sense of this. Now, an electron transport chain is not shown here, but it would be just off to the side. We're really close up here. This is a tiny little section of membrane that you see here, and this is not plasma membrane. This is the inner membrane of the mitochondrion. And so the orange space is the intermembrane space, as you see labeled. The yellow space is the mitochondrial matrix. So before we get to what's shown here, just remember that the many copies of electron transport chains that are also in this same membrane are busy transporting electrons so that the release of that energy can be used to power the proton pumps, taking protons from the yellow matrix, pumping them through the inner membrane into the orange intermembrane space. That's the gradient. There's a higher concentration of hydrogen ions or protons in this intermembrane space than in the yellow matrix. Now, I also told you in the lab that a gradient is not enough for diffusion to occur. A gradient is the tendency for diffusion to occur, but what's the other requirement for actual diffusion? You have to have a gradient, but what else do you have to have? This is not looking good for the test, I have to say.
Is it like just diffusion or osmosis?
Well, osmosis is diffusion, right. But so just passive transport in general.
Was it like a semi-permeable membrane or something like that?
Well, if there is a semi-permeable membrane in place, that's a good example of why you need the second requirement, which is a way to get from A to B. That's the other requirement. It's not enough to just have a gradient. There also has to be a way to get from A to B, right? Well, the protons want to get back in the matrix because that's down their gradient. And they don't care how they get there. But as small as they are, they're plenty small. Remember we talked about things getting directly through the phospholipid bilayer. They have to be either small or uncharged. Small and uncharged. Well, they're plenty small because they're even smaller than an atom. But they are fully charged particles. They're ions. So they don't want to be around these tails. And therefore, they don't easily get directly through the phospholipid bilayer of the membrane. The only places in the membrane that they're allowed to diffuse back into the matrix are the many copies, one of which we see here, of this molecular machine called an ATP synthase. Where are my pens? No, always lose these. ATP synthase is the name for this overall purple and blue thing combined. And just looking at the name, you should be able to tell this is what kind of thing. It is an enzyme. It ends in A-S-E, the name. And it gets named for the fact that it performs a synthesis. To synthesize, syn means together. To synthesize means to bring things together. Well, the two things that get synthesized by the help of this enzyme, ATP synthase, are ADP and inorganic phosphate. When you synthesize those, that's just another way of saying that you phosphorylate the ADP. And the result is ATP. Anyway, that's why it's called ATP synthase. Let's look at the fact that it's truly a molecular machine. It's truly a machine because machines have moving parts. And this is built much like a motor. If you ever worked on motors, there's a part that stays stationary or static, in other words, not moving, and that's called the stator. And then there's a part that rotates with respect to that stationary part, that's called the rotor. You have a stator and a rotor in an ATP synthase. But the whole thing is part of the inner mitochondrial membrane. It's kept there. It's not covalently bonded, remember, so it can move around horizontally within the membrane, like we talked about in the fluid mosaic model. But it's kept there. It's kept from going up or down in this because of polar regions being next to other polar regions, like I've discussed. Now, the rotor, which is the blue part, has this internal rod that is connected to the rest of the rotor down here at the catalytic knob. And this catalytic knob, notice, is not actually embedded in the membrane. It's connected to part that's in the membrane, but it's fully, the knob itself is fully inside the matrix, in the fluid of the matrix. And there's several catalytic knobs on this end part. They're all basically identical. Each one of them is really in itself an enzyme. When we talked about allosteric regulation, we looked at a 4-subunit protein, remember? Each subunit had its own active site, and you could lock it into the active form. Similarly, each one of these catalytic knobs has an active site for ADP and inorganic phosphate, which it brings together or synthesizes to make ATP. But the thing about this is that each catalytic knob cannot work as an enzyme unless it has the right shape, of course, and it doesn't have the right shape if this rotor is not spinning. When the rotor spins, each catalytic knob in turn, as it spins, gets deformed into the correct shape for it to act as an enzyme. So that's what allows the activation energy to be lowered, which is what enzymes do in general, right? This deformation of the shape of each catalytic knob. As long as the rotor is spinning in ATP synthase, ATP will be produced. But spinning doesn't happen for free, right? Things don't move for free. And that's where you have the payoff in terms of the gradient that you just established with electron transport. The electron transport chains are busy using the energy released from the electrons being transferred to power the pumping of protons from matrix to intermembrane space to create the gradient. And now, since these ATP synthase machines are the only places along the membrane surface that the protons can get back into the space they were pumped from and want to get back into by diffusion. That's the only place they do diffuse. And that diffusion, just like water hitting the paddles of a water wheel, turning the wheel, the diffusion of protons is what spins the rotor, activating the catalytic knobs so that ADP and inorganic phosphate get put together to form ATP. And that's where, by far, the majority of the ATP that can be produced from the energy that was originally in one glucose gets produced in this final step. So that's the final payoff for all these taxis carrying enormous amounts of energy to the final step, to the step of oxidative phosphorylation. And this, even though this ATP is no different from the ATP produced in glycolysis and the citric acid cycle, it's produced a little bit differently because it's inorganic phosphate on its own that gets stuck onto ADP. It's not a substrate transferring the phosphate to ADP. So this is not substrate-level phosphorylation. This is oxidative phosphorylation. If this rotor stops, though, no more ATP production. And it will stop if the pumps stop, right? Because if the pumps stop, you still have a gradient of protons for the moment, but eventually they will diffuse to the point where there's equal concentrations. So there's no tendency for them to come back in, and they're no longer going to spin the wheel. Just like in the open hydroelectric systems, once you get the two levels of the water even, it's no longer turning the turbine and lighting the light. So that's why you have to have a continuous gradient in place by having those pumps that are part of the electron transport chains, complexes 1, 3, and 4, working. Let's look at an anatomical diagram in 19 of both parts of oxidative phosphorylation. Oxidative phosphorylation is part 3 of cellular respiration, but it has two parts, electron transport and chemiosmosis. Okay. Electron transport, of course, involves the electron transport chains. This is just one copy of it, but there are millions. And that involves transfer of electrons from one member to another. That releases energy, allowing three members of the chain, 1, 3, and 4 complex, to use that energy to pump protons from the matrix through the membrane to the intermembrane space, creating the gradient. The gradient is now the still usable form of energy that was in glucose. The tendency for hydrogen ions or protons to diffuse back in is the gradient, but they can get in back in only through ATP synthase molecules, which spins the rotor, phosphorylating ADP into ATP. Now, let me see. Okay, I can go to 20. 20 is a summary of the entire process. This is a summary of the complete oxidation of glucose. And it looks very similar to the summary slide we started with before I gave you the details of the process. A little bit more detail is shown here, but not all that much. It's worth reviewing what happens, though. We did a little bit of this review earlier today. The overall process, complete oxidation of glucose, has two major parts. Glycolysis, which itself is 10 parts. And glycolysis is the splitting of glucose, a single 6-carbon compound, a fuel molecule, into 2 3-carbon pyruvate molecules, which are also fuel, just partially spent fuel. Since you partially spent the glucose, though, to split it into the pyruvates, you get some useful energy. You lose some as heat, but you get some in the form of ATP that's produced via substrate-level phosphorylation. And also you store some of that energy from glucose in the form of reduced coenzymes, NADH and H+. That leaves pyruvate as still the usable fuel, which is why if a cell is capable, and not all are, of continuing to process the pyruvate, it's definitely worth it. That's what cellular respiration is all about. But that takes place in a different compartment. Glycolysis happens in the cytosol. Cellular respiration happens in a mitochondrion in a eukaryote. So the very first part of cellular respiration involves getting that pyruvate into the mitochondrion. But it's more than just transporting it in, which is why the first part of cellular respiration isn't just called the transport of pyruvate. It's called the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. Because in the course of transporting it in there, a CO2, which is part of the 3-carbon pyruvate, gets stripped. That's decarboxylation. A carboxyl group comes off as CO2. And that leaves a 2-carbon still useful fuel called an acetyl group that gets picked up by a taxi called coenzyme A. And the full taxi with the acetyl as a passenger is called acetyl coenzyme A. All right. Now, in that step, you don't make any ATP, but you do make more reduced coenzyme, NADH and H+. The fuel at this point is just the simple 2-carbon acetyl that gets dropped off by coenzyme A, to the next part, part 2 of cellular respiration, which is the citric acid cycle. All right? The coenzyme A doesn't enter the cycle. It just drops off acetyl. That empties the taxi so it can go back and pick up more acetyl. Okay, but the acetyl fuel gets put into the citric acid cycle, and as the citric acid cycle turns, it totally dismantles what's left of that fuel. And so it releases more CO2, and at this point, no fuel is left. You've gotten CO2 in these first two parts of cellular respiration, and that adds up to 6 CO2s per glucose. Totally spent fuel. But more ATP is produced by substrate-level phosphorylation in citric acid cycle, and more reduced coenzymes are made in the form of NADH and H+, and also FADH2. And look at all these taxis that were produced along the way. They are all carrying electrons and protons to the same destination, which is electron transport chains operating for the first part of part 3 of cellular respiration. Oxidative phosphorylation is part 3, and the first part of that is electron transport. That's the destination for the taxis. They dump them all off, these electrons and protons. The electrons get transferred down the chains to release energy, powering the pumps that are members of the chain to pump protons, which are also carried by the taxis, from one side of the membrane to the other. So this is the matrix right here. This is the intermembrane space. This is the inner membrane. This is the intermembrane space. This is the way the pumping occurs, from matrix to intermembrane space. They want to get back in, and will, but only through ATP synthase molecules. That spins the rotors, and that's what's called chemiosmosis. And as you see, already told you that the vast majority of the possible ATP that can be produced from glucose is produced in this chemiosmosis step. So 32 or 34 ATP and only 4 from the other two places combined. Really worth doing if you have a mitochondrion to do it. But some books incorrectly tell you that glycolysis is part of cellular respiration. It's not. Glycolysis happens regardlessly, or the cell is dead. Glycolysis happens in any case. Cellular respiration can happen after that, and it will if the cell is capable and if there is a final electron acceptor at the end of the chains to take those electrons off. So that's what I want you to think of right now, now that we've had this summary. Oxygen is not required for glycolysis. Oxygen is not required for the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. Oxygen is not required for the citric acid cycle. It's required only for electron transport because it serves as that final electron acceptor and allows more electrons to keep coming through the chain. So obviously, a lack of oxygen is going to stop the chain, right? The chain will just fill up, which means no more electron transport, and therefore the pumping shuts down. So that's going to shut down electron transport, and without a gradient of protons, it's going to shut down chemiosmosis and cut off ATP production via that route. Correct? But even though oxygen is not required for those previous steps, those steps would shut down also in the absence of oxygen. Here's why. Imagine that no more oxygen, the chains are filling up. There's millions of copies of the chains, but eventually if they're all filled, what does that say about the taxis? The destinations of the taxis are the chains. If all the chains are full, what happens to the taxis?
Just build up like the chains did. It's the chains filling up, not everything else filling up, but with the taxis.
Right. The taxis themselves will be all filled. When every taxi in town is carrying a passenger, it's like there's no taxis available, right? When oxygen is available, taxis keep dumping passengers off, which is important because that produces a new empty taxi, which can go back to these earlier parts like glycolysis and pick up more electrons. But once you have the situation that all of the taxis, every NAD and every FAD is full already, reduced, then they can't go back to the earlier points and pick up electrons, which means glycolysis and everything past it would be shut down as well, even though they don't directly require oxygen. Am I making sense on that? Okay, so that would kill the cell because you cannot exist without glycolysis. Luckily, though, there is an alternative biochemical pathway, alternative to cellular respiration. Cellular respiration is a chemical pathway, right? It's really a set of pathways. But it's separate from glycolysis. Glycolysis happens in any case, and cellular respiration can follow that. If cellular respiration gets shut down, though, because there isn't a final electron acceptor anymore, absence of oxygen, then there has to be some other alternative pathway to keep the cell alive. And this alternative pathway does the same thing for the taxis that cellular respiration does, which is to reoxidize them, to empty them of their passengers. That's why the cell can remain alive, because if you have empty taxis again, they can drive back to glycolysis and allow glycolysis to happen. With only full taxis, the glycolytic pathway or glycolysis is going to shut down. Well, let's look at 21, which shows you a couple examples of this alternative pathway. There are many versions of this alternative pathway, depending on species. Any given species only performs one version. But the alternative pathway is called fermentation. Fermentation is an alternative to cellular respiration. And what I'm saying is that different species have different versions of fermentation. Just two are shown here, but that's not a complete list. Textbooks will kind of imply that there are only two, because there's only ever two that are mentioned in basic textbooks, even though there's many more than that. And that's because there's two that humans really care about more than the other. One of them we care about more than the other because it's the type of fermentation that our bodies do. So that's why we care about it. And that's the bottom example. Lactic acid fermentation. That's our version. And the other one, which is alcohol fermentation we really care about because we take advantage of it industrially to produce alcohol for various reasons. But there's other versions. Despite the difference in the details of the pathways, the reason they exist evolutionarily, the goal of fermentation is the same for all versions, which is to reoxidize NADH back into NAD+, so you have empty taxis to allow glycolysis to continue. Do you remember when we talked just about glycolysis in terms of inputs and outputs? The fuel input is glucose. You have to have an input in the form of ADP to come out as ATP. And you have to have an input of NAD+ in order to have an output of NADH. If you don't have NAD+, if you look at the details of those steps of glycolysis in the slides, those steps that require NAD+ shut down, and therefore everything beyond that shuts down. So you have to have oxidized coenzymes, NAD+ specifically, in order for glycolysis to happen. That's what fermentation provides, a way to reoxidize already reduced coenzymes, NADH, back into the oxidized form, NAD+. Now, glycolysis, as we've already studied, produces a little bit of ATP. Fermentation, this is another thing that gets improperly implied by textbooks, fermentation by itself doesn't produce any ATP. It's glycolysis that produces the ATP, but when glycolysis is coupled with fermentation, it's fermentation that allows the glycolysis to happen. Whereas, if oxygen is available, you wouldn't bother with fermentation because instead you use cellular respiration, which has the advantage of producing a lot more ATP, but it also has the effect of reoxidizing the NADH into NAD+. So that allows glycolysis and the rest to continue to happen as well. Okay? Fermentation by itself does not produce any ATP. Well, for things that undergo alcohol fermentation, like this is what yeast do, for instance, the yeast that we use in brewing, alcohol fermentation exploits yeast's fermentation to make alcohol for us. And it's the same exact alcohol, whether it's beer, wine, or spirits. It's just how much we concentrate it is the difference. But notice what's happening here in alcohol fermentation. Glycolysis, of course, spits out pyruvate. Fermentation then, alcohol fermentation, takes the pyruvate, which is a three-carbon compound, and decarboxylates it. That's where the CO2 comes from. That leaves a two-carbon compound called acetaldehyde, which then gets transformed into ethanol, that's the alcohol. And in that step of transforming acetaldehyde to ethanol, that's what allows for NADH to be reoxidized. So in other words, acetaldehyde gets reduced into alcohol where the source of electrons are the ones being carried by NADH. That reoxidizes the NADH into NAD+. That allows glycolysis to continue. And this explains why when you use this, when you take advantage of yeast doing this to brew, the beer that you produce is not only alcoholic, it's also carbonated, naturally, because CO2 comes off of the pyruvate in the process. Okay? Well, we don't do that. If we did this kind of fermentation, we could just hold our breath and get drunk. Right? We would produce alcohol just by depriving ourselves of oxygen. But that would be dangerous because we would also put CO2 into our blood, which would acidify the blood. Instead, humans and other animals use lactic acid fermentation, which is kind of a more direct step. There is no decarboxylation, so there is no CO2 produced. The pyruvate itself gets directly reduced into lactate or lactic acid, and that's what allows NADH to get reoxidized into NAD+. The effect is exactly the same. The whole reason these organisms are doing whatever version is to get NAD+, not to get whatever the final product is. That's just a way of something you have to do in order to get NAD+. And as a matter of fact, when it comes to lactic acid in us, that's something we have to deal with. If you jog, which is not full speed running, then as long as you have energy in your body, you're eating while you're jogging or you're burning your fat that's in your body, you can jog kind of indefinitely, because since you're not running at full speed, your lungs are working well enough to supply your blood with enough oxygen, and your heart is pumping well enough to send that blood to the cells of your body, so that the cells of your body, which are using the oxygen, have enough oxygen for cellular respiration to continue. And that produces a lot of energy. When you sprint, you know, if you've ever sprinted, that you can't do it very long, right? It's a short burst of energy. When you're sprinting, you are using your muscles far beyond the capacity for your lungs and blood to supply enough oxygen. And so the muscles have no choice but to switch to fermentation instead to produce a little bit of ATP from the glucose. And in the process, the byproduct is lactic acid, which builds up in the blood and acidifies the cells, which is part of the fatigue feeling. This is why it's a temporary process. You might want to continue sprinting, but your body's going to make you collapse. There's just nothing you can do about it. And as a matter of fact, it's not the end of it when you just stop running, right? When you stop running, you don't just sit down and it's like you never ran. You're really panting for a long time after that, even though you're just sitting there, right? And the reason is, you have to use a lot of oxygen to produce a lot of energy via cellular respiration once you've stopped in order to deal with all this lactic acid that build up. That takes energy to transform back into stuff that doesn't harm you. And that's what we call the oxygen debt. Okay, so that is fermentation and why it exists. In 22, we see the process as a fork in the road, or fermentation is one lane in the fork of the road. As I said before, glycolysis has to happen, or you're dead. It happens whether cellular respiration happens or not. It's not part of cellular respiration. It's part of the complete oxidation of glucose. When you get to the pyruvate, which is the end of glycolysis, that's the fork in the road. And there are two choices. The two alternatives are cellular respiration and fermentation. Well, it's definitely worth going down the cellular respiration route. Not only do you accomplish what you need to in terms of emptying the taxis, but you also have the enormous advantage of producing a hell of a lot more ATP if you go down the cellular respiration route. Go down the fermentation route, there's no more ATP. You're just stuck with the two that you got from glycolysis. The only thing is it allows you to continue to undergo glycolysis. So how does the cell know which way to go? Well, obviously it doesn't know. It doesn't have to know anything. It's automatic. Cellular respiration happens if it can. And it can and will as long as there are full taxis being able to deliver electrons to the chains, right? Well, if they are able to deliver them to the chains, that means the chains must be emptying at the other end. So if oxygen is present, that will keep the chains being emptied, and therefore taxis will automatically deliver their electrons to the cellular respiration electron transport chains. Only if you don't have something at the end of the chain, so you don't have the oxygen operating as the final electron acceptor, will it automatically switch to fermentation. Because that's the only other alternative. It's the only way that you can get these reduced coenzymes back into oxidized form. All right, 23. I think this might be the last slide. 23 is the overall process for this whole chapter, the complete oxidation of glucose, shown in kind of a flowchart form. The complete oxidation of glucose is the central metabolic pathway that we're looking at here. And we've been talking about it in terms of glucose, which is the most important fuel. But glucose is not the only possible fuel. We didn't look at the tiny details of every single step along the way, every individual reaction. But you saw enough of glycolysis, for instance. There's steps in cellular respiration, of course, as well. But just within glycolysis, you saw that there were intermediates, right? Pathways have intermediates. The first product is an intermediate. It gets fed into the second reaction, which produces another intermediate, and so on. So if glucose is used, of course, as a fuel, but other things can be used as well, and they really can just be fed into this central pathway somewhere other than the starting place, which is where glucose enters. Now, at the top, we have the three major nutrient classes. No matter what food you eat, those macromolecules that are made out of don't come into your body. Right? The stuff that you eat is not in your body. It's just in the tube that you're wrapped around. Those macromolecules include, as you see, fats, proteins, and carbohydrates. Those are still outside your body. The big ones are too big to get in, so that's why we have a digestive system to break them into small enough molecules, the monomers that these things are made out of, so that they can finally enter your body. All right? So digestion of proteins means breaking them into their monomers, which are amino acids. Digestion of large carbohydrates means breaking them down into monosaccharides. Digestion of fats means breaking them down into their constituent parts, which are glycerol and fatty acids. We've studied all these components before. Those things, these subunits, are then small enough to get in the cells and then be eligible as fuels. So a lot of the monosaccharides that come from the carbohydrates in your food are glucose already. Glucose is ready to go, and it enters at the start line. Goes through the whole process that we just studied. But there are other monosaccharides besides glucose, of course, right? Like fructose, for instance. Well, if you look at the glycolysis detail, you'll see that one of the steps involves turning glucose into fructose. So if you start with fructose instead of glucose, you just skip that step and put fructose into a later step of the same pathway, and so on for other monosaccharides. So they're pretty easy to get in different places, the sugars, the monosaccharides. Now if we consider fats, part of a fat when you break it apart is glycerol. Well, glycerol is also one of the members of the intermediates. And so it can be fed into the glycolytic pathway, which is the green box or teal box. Fatty acids skip glycolysis entirely. Remember what a fatty acid is. It's a carboxyl group with a hydrocarbon chain. Remember that? And so the hydrocarbon chain is really just a bunch of carbons and hydrogens. But the very end of the chain, no matter how long it is going to have three hydrogens, right? The rest of them are going to have two, like we've talked about. Well, when you have a long chain as a fatty acid, and you just take off two of those carbons from the end, that is an acetyl group. Just like the acetyl group that's left when pyruvate gets decarboxylated in the first part of cellular respiration. So, That's why you can skip glycolysis with a fat. You just take off two of its carbons in the form of an acetyl group, and coenzyme A will think that's the same passenger. It is chemically the same passenger as if it had decarboxylated pyruvate. That's why they feed into right here, and then everything after that is the same. Proteins are not actually used as fuels all that much. You don't really need all that much protein because proteins get recycled. Since they're not used as fuel, they're not consumed. They're used to build structures, which are kind of permanent, or they're used to replace structures that are destroyed and so on. They can be used as fuels, but there's a problem with doing that. And that's because unlike carbohydrates and fats, which are nothing but carbons, hydrogens, and oxygens, proteins being made of amino acids means they have nitrogen. Amino means nitrogen. Every individual amino acid, by definition, has a nitrogen in it. And that's a problem because nitrogen isn't part of this central pathway. So in order to prepare an amino acid to use it as a fuel instead of using it for something else, like to build a protein, you have to deaminate it. Remove NH3, which is ammonia, from that amino acid. That will leave just carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen, so it can be fed into different places. And it's different places because it depends on the amino acid. Right? There's 20 different biological amino acids. You can deaminate all of them, but you're left with different stuff depending on the amino acid. And so they feed into different places. But this is the central pathway because all of these different fuels will feed in at different places, and they'll all therefore lead to production of ATP. So they all contain energy, just like glucose does. Oh, I guess that wasn't the last slide, but 24 is, and I have plenty of time to finish this. It's not too much more. This is that central pathway again, but now we can see feedback involved in the control of it. And notice that there are green and red arrows. Red is an inhibitory feedback mechanism. Just like when we talked about feedback inhibition before, that was inhibitory. Well, notice that ATP acts as an inhibitor on one of the key enzymes in glycolysis. Why would that make sense? Because if you already have a lot of ATP, why would you keep running this process of making a bunch more ATP at full bore? That would be wasteful, right? So when the cell is not even using the ATP that you have, it builds up to the point of interfering with the process of producing more ATP and automatically, by feedback, turns down the process. Similarly, citrate, which builds up if the citric acid cycle is running too much, can interfere. Those are inhibitory. Notice that AMP stimulates the process. Now, why does that make sense? What is AMP?
I don't know what AMP stands for, but I know it's monophosphate.
The A is the same as ATP. It's adenosine monophosphate. So it's also a nucleotide, but it's a much lower energy nucleotide because two of the phosphates of ATP have already been removed. So that's like a zero balance debit card. That's an emergency situation that requires a deposit, right? You have a pool of nucleotides in your cells in one of three forms, ATP, ADP, AMP. Most of them are in the form of ATP or ADP. And it just keeps going back and forth between those two, right? ADP gets recharged into ATP. ATP gets used to make ADP. If you are doing some activity, and I don't necessarily mean exercise, just cellular activity that requires a lot of energy, you first turn a bunch of ATPs into ADP. Well, you can then dephosphorylate the ADPs to make AMP, get more energy out of them. But what that tells the cell, if the AMP starts building up, that's a strong signal to the cell that you are not producing ATP at a rate sufficient to meet the demands for ATP. So that's why AMP, when it's in high concentration, will get this ramped up and produce a lot more ATP, turning this back into ATP. And notice that when AMP gets turned back into ATP, AMP is no longer here to stimulate it anymore, and it will get back to its normal pace. So it gets turned up or turned down appropriately for whatever is happening currently in the cell. That's feedback in both cases. Now I think we are done.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to spend 5 minutes to start the photosynthesis chapter. We'll start that on Monday.